Case number 08-1356, Petaluma FX Partners, LLC, et al., Appellants versus Commissioner of Internal Revenue Service. Mr. Robbins for the appellants, Ms. Oppenheimer for the appellee.
Now, Austin, we get three of us old guys to battle one of us needs to run.
Okay.
You guys are younger this morning. Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Edward Robbins for the appellant. I'd like to start with a few points, may it please the court. The problem that we have with what the government has done in this case can be highlighted immediately by looking at the Notice of Final Partnership Administrative Adjustment, the so-called FPA, that started this case. The FPA sets forth a variety of numerical adjustments to the partnership return and attaches to that schedule an explanation of adjustments, which includes a series of alternative legal arguments that the commissioner has to, in effect, disallow everything having to do with the partnership anywhere. Sham, lack of economic substance, lack of profit motive, a variety of citations to code sections under the Internal Revenue Code, all of which, at the end of the day, eliminate whatever losses might come out of this partnership to the taxpayer. The problem we have is that the FPA is different than the usual statutory notice of deficiency you have in a regular case. In a statutory notice of deficiency in a normal individual case, the government does this sort of stuff all the time. They set forth adjustments, and then they have an explanation as to why we're making these adjustments. If the taxpayer does not challenge that statutory notice of deficiency, the deficiency is assessed.
Your time is limited, and you may want to move from the background to this case, counsel.
This is my central point, Your Honor. The determination of statutory notice is not conclusive. In a FPA, the determinations of partnership items are conclusive. They cannot be challenged anywhere. They're conclusive in subsequent litigation between the partners and the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. They're conclusive in subsequent years between the partners and the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. The FPA is unique in that respect. And I submit to you.
Is it correct to say, counsel, that the issues in this case are first whether the tax court had jurisdiction to determine that Petaluma was a sham. Second, whether the tax court had jurisdiction to determine that Petaluma's partners had no outside basis. Third, whether it had jurisdiction to determine the applicability of accuracy-related penalties. And fourth, whether the court erred in holding that the valuation misstatement penalties applied.
Yes, sir.
That's actually the issues in the case, right?
If you put the word partnership item in there and, mm-hmm. and flag those yep. as partnership items, because that's all they have.
Why the A and B issues in particular involve jurisdictions where these partnership
yes.
items.
They only have jurisdiction so to determine
given
partnership
the limits
items.
Of time, you may wish to move to those issues because we have all read the background that you spent your time on so far. Now, if you win on either A or B, then the first or second issue, jurisdiction over the sham question and jurisdiction over the basis question, then the case is, you've won the case, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'm building up to the point of why they don't have jurisdiction over sham.
Get to the point.
I'm working on it, Your Honor. I have 13 minutes to make my point.
You have 11 left.
Thank you, sir. It is undisputed that a partnership item determined from the FPA, If it's not challenged, it is conclusively determined. My point is,
In the individual partner proceedings, could it be determined that the partnership was a sham?
I think so.
Okay. The government is suggesting.
Government says no.
The government says no.
Well, correct. The partnership items are conclusively determined. And my point is, Your Honor, that sham cannot be a partnership item because
that's what I'm trying to get
you. It can't be conclusively determined because if you look at that explanation of adjustments, they have set forth under the government's own theory a dozen alternative legal theories which cannot be conclusively determined. They're inconsistent. They are different.
Why can't sham be conclusively determined?
It could if it was the only one that they floated.
I don't understand why that matters.
Because under the government's theory, right now, in this case, every one of those theories in that FPAW are conclusively determined. And that just cannot be because they are inconsistent. You can't do that.
I don't see why that precludes the possibility of the question of sham being conclusively determined. If they offer three reasons and two of them are right, what does it matter whether the third one's wrong?
Well, if they offer three conclusive reasons and two of them are wrong, well, then those two aren't conclusive.
Yeah, but the first might be.
Mm-hmm. But how do you know that? And that's my point. You don't know which one until they tell you at the end of the day,
I guess. I'm trying to break it down the way Chief Judge Sentelle was. I'm trying to focus on the first issue, which is, doesn't it make sense to determine the question of sham in the partnership proceeding rather than an individual partner proceeding?
I submit it does not, because sham is, if you want to pigeonhole it as a partnership item or an affected item or a non-partnership item, it's an affected item. It has components to it that relate to the partnership, but it's a facts and circumstances test which necessarily suck in facts that are relevant only to the partners and things that have nothing to do with the partnership. The cases are clear. Sham's a facts and circumstances test. It takes in everything, facts beyond just what's going on at the partnership level. And I might add,
what would happen then if the sham were determined at the partner level proceeding? What effect would that have on the partnership or the other partners? Wouldn't you have to go through that same proceeding for every other partner? Doesn't that run it cross purposes for the TEPA reform? The answer is yes.
Okay. And I think that's what should have been done here. Now, keep in mind.
Now, that's easily done when you just have two or three partners.
Correct.
What if you have a larger partnership of 500 people?
It's certainly more difficult. But
isn't that what the TEPA reforms were primarily about, was to streamline unify?
Yes. Yes, they were. Here, however, we have two partners.
But if we make law that this is not a partnership item, That'd apply if you had 150 partners then, wouldn't it?
Sure. It would. Your point is...
Be a partner-level item instead of a partnership-level item?
Excuse me?
Still be an affected item instead of a partnership item?
I believe it's properly characterized as an affected item, and the government, at least in that one field service report that I cited in one of my footnotes, agreed with that. That's the way they originally characterized it internally until they came up with this new theory.
They're not bound by an internal theory.
I understand that. I'm just giving you a little history as to where they came from in evolving this theory. So my point is that the notion that all of these legal theories somehow morph into partnership items is incorrect. Number two, outside basis. Now, that was an interesting result from Petaluma, because no one below ever argued that. The tax court came up with that on their own.
Isn't that your stronger issue, the outside basis, rather than the partnership being a sham?
I like the first one better, but unfortunately I've lost it in two other courts, so probably you're right as a practical matter. It's an issue of first impression coming out of the tax court on the outside basis issue. They're wrong on that. Outside basis clearly has lots of components that are not determined at the partnership level, and everybody knew that. I mean, the commissioner never once suggested what the tax court did in Petaluma, that if you have a sham partnership, you don't have to deal with outside basis at the partner level in an affected item statutory notice of deficiency. I don't think they're correct. And the reason they're not correct is because it's clear under the case law and other regulations that outside basis is an affected item. It's also clear when you look at that FPAW.
Well,
Well, I think they concede that's generally the case, but this is an unusual circumstance where it wouldn't make any sense. I think they term it absurd and nonsensical to think there could be a separate outside basis determination. You want to respond to that?
Yeah, if that's correct, that gets back to my first point. We shouldn't even be here. If it's so obvious and the sham characterization just negates any analysis of what's going on at the partner level with their partnership, they should have issued a statutory notice of deficiency, cut out this TEFRA, and gone right at the partnership if it's that simple. I understand the judge's argument in the tax court. It's kind of a clever argument that if the thing's sham, then why are we here? We don't have to do anything. Outside basis is zero.
We're here because of statute of limitations, in fact, right?
Yeah, sure.
Right. Okay. Excuse me. Go ahead.
That meant ultimately, yes, that's right. If the FPAW is no good, the statute's blown for collection.
There's a sentence in the government's brief I want you to respond to, which is, since there is no partnership for federal tax purposes, there's no partnership interest as to which there could be any outside basis, and nothing in a partner-level proceeding could alter this fundamental reality.
What page is that, Darn?
Page 50, the last sentence. Is that true?
Well, I see what Ms. Oppenheimer is saying there. If you agree with the tax court's analysis that once you sham the partnership, there's nothing left to do on outside basis or anything else, everything gets a zero. Makes sense.
What would be left to do? That's what I'm asking.
At the individual level. That's a good question, and that's the subject of other litigation in other cases. I say there's nothing to do if Petaluma is correct. In fact, you don't even need a statutory notice of deficiency, an affected item statutory notice of deficiency. You just go ahead and make the calculation, assess the tax.
Would this sentence be true if the adjective outside were left out? Explain what I mean. If this tax is dependent upon a transaction, then even though there may not be something styled outside basis, doesn't there have to be some sort of basis calculation to determine tax liability?
I think not.
You don't?
Yeah.
How was liability to be determined?
At the partner level?
Yeah.
Just look at the return and eliminate everything having to do with the partnership. Make the comp.
I'm not sure I understood that. Eliminate everything having to do with the partnership. Leaves what, then, with reference to the tax liability that we're litigating about?
It depends on what, here.
Where did that liability come from, unless it came from a transaction? It
came from the partnership. It came from a transaction where what happened was they had inflated outside basis in the partnership. They liquidated the partnership and had some assets with inflated basis, which was a carryover.
So how does the amount of income get calculated?
Like it is with any other taxpayer, you eliminate the partnership materials and make the comp. It's pretty straightforward.
That is the most unhelpful answer I could have imagined. Well, now, make the call does not tell me how you calculate anything. How do you make the call? You don't pick a number out of the air. You compute a number based on something.
You compute a number based on the tax return as filed, eliminating anything having to do with the partnership.
Yeah. So then you don't have this transaction at all if you eliminated everything completely. A transaction that generated tax liability, do you
correct.
Not? Yes, right. And how do you calculate the tax that results from that transaction?
Once you eliminate the transaction.
You eliminate the partnership. You
correct.
Still got to calculate the tax liability based on something.
Correct.
You don't call that making the call. You call that a calculation. What you calculate.
Making the computation.
Okay.
You go to the 1040, the individual income tax return. You identify every item on that return positive or negative for the taxpayer that relates to that partnership.
Forget all the other items.
Zero it out.
Forget all the other items on return. Look at what we're litigating about here.
Right.
They came up with a number on which tax liability was based. What is the comp? Don't just tell me you make the comp. Tell me what the computation is.
Here?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but you would look.
I don't care what
you would look at the stock sale.
Yeah.
And you would eliminate the inflated basis on that stock sale.
So you calculate basis some way. I'm not trying to be hostile to you at all here, counsel, but I am trying to get an answer.
The basis.
There has to be a basis calculation. So the sentence that the government has in their brief, if it omitted the word outside, would no longer be a true statement, right? There would have to be some basis calculation at the partner level.
Well, to the extent you're reducing it to zero, yeah.
Zeroed out, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah, but it has to be done at the partner level.
Yes. Right? Yes. I guess my point was it's not
There's some argument that even if the partnership is a sham, that it shouldn't be zeroed out.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I think my time is up.
I think your time is up in three minutes.
I can...
We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
I appreciate it. I'm sorry I wasn't clear with my responses to your questions.
Thank you, counsel.
I'm Joan Oppenheimer, attorney for the appellee. It is totally unnecessary in this case to look at the FPA to determine that this court has jurisdiction to determine that the partnership was a sham. Section 6233 of the code and the regulations under it, which appellant studiously avoids, gives the court that jurisdiction. Furthermore, 6233 basically requires that a partnership proceeding be held any time that a partnership is returned, if partnership return is filed by a partnership.
This is a two-step issue, though. You first have the question of the jurisdiction to determine the sham status, and then you have the discrete question of whether the tax court had jurisdiction to determine the basis question.
Yes.
Outside basis question.
And then you get to penalties.
Yeah, then you get to penalties. But you don't get to penalties if the government loses on either one of those, right?
Well, if we lose on the first one, we don't get to penalties. It's my position that we would get to penalties even if we lose on the outside basis issue. And my reason for that is all items on the partnership return were zeroed out, including contributions to the partnership. So if the Vanderbeeks made no contribution to the partnership, they weren't partners. So then you would get to penalties without looking at outside basis, but simply on the undisputed fact that there were no contributions to the partnership.
TEFRA would still apply even if this is a sham, right?
That's correct under the regulations under 6233 and under 6233. 6233 basically applies that if a partnership return is filed and if there is no partnership, then TEFRA still applies.
Now, 6231, is more relevant to whether this is a partnership item, that is to say the basis. On the sham, I frankly think you have an awfully good argument that that's a partnership item, but I'm not sure I understand why the outside basis question is a partnership item as opposed to an affected item.
Well, outside basis is an affected item, but it is composed of partnership items that can only be determined in a partnership proceeding.
Does that fit the language of 6231 to get it within the jurisdiction of the partnership level, get it within the partnership level?
Well, it's our position, our primary position is that under 6233, this court has jurisdiction to determine whether the partnership is a sham, and this court never even needs to reach the issue of whether the sham nature of a partnership is a partnership item This court simply never needs to get to the so-called partnership item determination because 6233 and the regulations under it expressly give this court jurisdiction to determine whether the partnership is a sham.
You are saying then that there's not a discrete issue as to whether the tax court had jurisdiction over the outside basis question as a partnership item?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry, that is a discrete issue.
Yes, it is a discrete issue, and that's what I'm asking you about now.
Okay.
What is your explanation as to why that is a partnership item?
Well, outside basis is not a partnership item. But once there is no partnership, there's no partners, there's no partnership interest, and there's no outside basis.
If it's not a partnership item, then could it have come up in this FPAA or whatever they're called, FPAA, could it have come up in this FPAA at the partnership level as opposed to being an item for the partner level?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the
question. Why is this at the partnership level? If it's, you just said there's no outside basis if it's a sham partnership. So why doesn't it go to the partner level instead of the partnership level? We're all talking about the statute of limitations.
Okay. The outside, outside basis refers to the partnership's partnership's interest in the partnership.
Why isn't that a partner question, partner level question, rather than a partnership level question?
Well, there is no. Let me answer your question to opposing counsel. If there is no partnership interest, you ask the question of how is the tax liability determined. So let me answer that question. Maybe that will.
Do that first, if you want.
All right. The Vanderbeek sold stock that was distributed from the partnership. If an outside basis refers to a partner's interest in the partnership, but certainly people sell stock with having a partnership interest. In that case, you simply have what's referred to as the basis. Basis is simply the cost that you paid for the stock. So you compute the Vanderbeeks, if there's no partnership.
That's what I was trying to get opposing counsel to say. Excuse me, go ahead, Johnson.
All right, so you compute the Vanderbeeks' liability by looking at the amount they received from the stock and you subtract the amount that they paid for the stock.
That's the right answer. But the next question then becomes, why do you need to determine that at the partnership level? I don't know why you're opposing counsel.
Well, you would not determine any of that at the partnership level. The question that would be determined at the partner level after the conclusion of the partnership proceeding. But what the Vanderbeeks did is they stepped up their basis in their stock by millions of dollars by virtue of these phony transactions.
If the statute of limitations runs from a computation of what it would be from the partner level, then you can't get the penalty on those millions. If it runs from the partnership level, the FPAA determination, then you can get it. And what I'm curious about is to why this would be a partnership item as opposed to an affected item, because that would seem to be important as to when the statute would run.
Well, the commencement of a partnership proceeding suspends the statute of limitations until a year after the conclusion of partnership proceedings. Now, if there were no partnership issues in this case and the FPAA was incorrectly issued, then we were out of luck. Then we would be out of luck. That seems to be the other side's argument. But basically, a partnership return was filed, and Section 6233 of the code says if a partnership return is filed by an entity for a taxable year, but it is determined that the entity is not a partnership for the year, then to the extent provided in the regulations, the provisions of this subchapter are hereby extended in respect to such year to such entity, and its items and to persons holding an interest in such entity. So basically, Section 6233 makes the TEFRA provisions applicable, and we had to send an FPAA out. And so, therefore, we get the extension of the statute of limitations by virtue of the fact that a partnership return was filed in this case.
It's not a partnership item. That doesn't save you, does it?
Well, yes, it does save us because since the provisions of TEFRA apply, the provision extending the statute of limitations for a year also applies.
Question is, what does it apply to? And from what you read me and from what I read, it applies to the partnership and its items, right?
Yes.
The quote partnership, close quote, and its items. So if it's not a partnership item, you don't get the extension, do you? If you do get the extension, what in the devil are we litigating over if this applies? You don't get that unless this is a partnership item, do you?
Well, the contributions, outside basis is composed of a number of items which are partnership items. It's composed of contributions to the partnership. The contribution to a partnership which the Vanderbeek supposedly made was a partnership item.
A specific answer to that specific question. If this is not a partnership item, you don't get the benefit of the statute of limitations suspension, do you?
Well, yes, we do, because
if you do, then why are we here? Why couldn't you just have asserted the deficiency against the individual Vanderbeeks, and there wouldn't be any issue?
Because since a partnership return was filed, we were required to issue an FPAW first, and opposing counsel challenged the FPAW. Had he never done so,
could you not nonetheless have asserted deficiency against the individuals at that point?
No, we could not. We had to disallow without issuing an FPAW.
When the FPAW issued?
No, because the statute gives them a certain number of days to commence a TEFRA partnership proceeding, and the statute we could issue a notice of deficiency at the same time, but it would be held in abeyance pending.
Nonetheless, that would have stopped the running of the statute, right?
Well, the statute of limitations by statute is suspended, I believe, under Section 6230 during the pendency of a partnership proceeding.
Partnership items. So aren't we back to where we started? Haven't we come full circle?
Well, it's suspended as to partnership item, but the contribution to a partnership is a partnership item. The distributions from the partnership are a partnership item.
Is outside and basis a partnership item?
No, but it is comprised of partnership items, and a partnership proceeding is necessary in order to determine the components of outside basis. In other words, almost all items of outside basis are partnership items. Contributions to partnership are a partnership item, and opposing counsel doesn't dispute that. Distributions from the partnership are a partnership item. And those items must be determined in a partnership proceeding and cannot be determined in a partner-level proceeding. And
determine that the partnership was a sham in a partner-level proceeding?
No, it cannot be, because it's a partnership item. And the RJT case in the Eighth Circuit,
if you went on an individual partner proceeding here, presumably the taxpayer would say, well, the partnership is not a sham.
Well,
in other words, I'm trying to explore whether there's a real problem going with the partner level proceeding instead of the partnership level, or you have to do both, or how you think.
Well, we would work. because a partnership return was filed under 6233, we would be bound to issue an FPAW because the sham nature of a partnership is a partnership item, as the Eighth Circuit held in RJT, in a case that's on all fours with this case.
Isn't it very often the case that after the FPAW is issued, there are partner-level transactions, proceedings, concerning items that were not partnership items? Am I not right in that?
Yes.
That is, in fact, the norm, right?
Right. Affected items would be determined.
Affected items have to be determined at the partner level.
That's correct.
So the question still is very critical as to whether this outside basis is a partnership item or an affected item. Is it not? That's a yes or no question.
It's an affected item that is consistent, that consists of partnership items that must be determined in a partnership proceeding. And when, as here, it is determined that a partnership is a sham, the tax court did not err in saying, since the partnership was a sham, there are no partners, there's no partnership interest, and there can be no basis in a disregarded entity.
The outside basis is necessarily zero in those circumstances.
Well, right. There is no outside basis. There's no partnership. So how can you have a basis in a non-existent entity?
Now, the Eighth Circuit didn't address, and I think both of you argued in the Eighth Circuit on this case, didn't address the outside basis issue, right?
That is correct.
Was that argued to them?
Or? That was an issue that wasn't raised in that case.
Okay. They're trying these one by one. We're peeling the onion to the heart of it sometimes.
If I can get to the penalties just for a brief moment. On the valuation misstatement.
Tell us how you get to the penalties if we don't agree with you on the outside basis.
I think you can still, the statute.
It talks about related to, is that
well, the statute, the penalties are required to be determined at the partnership level. And they have been in every case that's been decided. There are exactly zero cases to support.
Is the key language the related to language of the statute, that this is
right,
related to?
Right, attributable to.
Related to the sham, and so therefore it can be done at partnership level. Is that the argument?
Yes. This statute basically requires all penalties relating to a partnership to be determined at the partnership level. And every Son of Boss case has determined penalties at the partnership level. And every Son of Boss case involves inflated bases. There is not a single case to support appellant's position on this point. Jade Trading is the best case for us. It's the same type of transaction here where, you know, basically involving these offsetting currency transactions. In that case, the transactions were held to be sham rather than the partnership. But every single case so far has determined penalties at the partnership level.
How many of these Son of Boss cases are there approximately?
In litigation, about 240.
What's the total money at stake approximately?
Billions. I have, just taking cases involving a six-year statute of limitations cases, that if you take 30 cases out of the 240 that involve a six-year statute of limitations issue, I think when you're looking at tax deficiencies, interest, 40% penalty, and interest on the penalties, that set of 30 is about $1 billion. And then you've got 210 more cases. The money is staggering.
Yeah, unless my colleagues have further questions, your time is up. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thanks, sir. Just a couple of points. The government lawyer referenced 6233, the code provision that provides that the court has jurisdiction to determine whether or not a partnership exists. Mm-hmm. I submit to you that that section is designed to cover, is it a corporation or is it a partnership? It's that sort of analysis.
Why do its terms not cover the question, is it a sham partnership?
Well, the sham, according to the government, is a partnership item that you don't even need this 6233 to get to.
But you still need jurisdiction to get there in 6233.
Yes.
I don't see why it matters that it may have been designed to go after something with a corporation or a partnership. It seems by its terms to say TEFRA continues to apply even if the partnership is a sham.
I don't think it says that. It says TEFRA applies even if it's determined the partnership does not exist,
right.
And that analysis is in the context of, is it a partnership or is it something else? The sham analysis, if you look at that code section and the regulations, is not there. That's not what it's talking about. And I don't think the tax court doesn't think that's
You keep saying, I don't think that, but why do the terms not seem to encompass the sham situation?
Because if you look at the Petaluma.
So tell me what you think, but why do the.
Look at what the judge in the Petaluma case said.
Judge Gulke didn't dwell on that. He immediately launched off into the sham as a partnership analysis, as a partnership item analysis. So while citing it as being there, his analysis did not rely on it. He quite clearly found
something that can be one step.
He quite clearly found that sham was a partnership item. He did not.
Yeah, right. But if there weren't jurisdiction to be doing this in the absence of a partnership, would he have even needed to do that?
I think my only answer I can give
you. First, say I have jurisdiction. Then you say in that jurisdiction falls the sham question.
He did not base his decision on 6233.
Okay. I think your time is again up, unless my colleagues have questions. We'll call it a day.
Thank you. I'm sorry I was so thick on your questions, sir.